It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, we're joined here today with somebody from Parkdale Organize. There's recently been a documentary that's been produced by Parkdale Organize and Submedia about a rent strike that went on at a housing complex in Toronto, Canada. We're going to be talking with somebody that was involved in the organizing of the rent strike. What went down? What happened? What were the relationships that were formed? What did people do? How did they carry out this massive endeavor and ultimately end up in a victory? But can you just introduce yourself real quick to the audience?
My name's Cole. I'm a member of Parkdale Organize.
And can you describe Parkdale in so-called Toronto in Canada, both as a housing complex and a neighborhood? What's it like for people that have never been there?
Yeah, Parkdale's historically working class and immigrant neighborhood in the southwest part of the city. And it's characterized by its high density of rental housing. So 90% of the people who live in Parkdale are renters. And Parkdale's the neighborhood within the city of Toronto where people spend the highest proportion of their income on rent. It's up around 50% on average. It's a neighborhood that's experienced gentrification forces for the last 20 years or so, but the predominance of mid and low rise apartment buildings in the neighborhood has meant that a working class population has been able to maintain its residency in the neighborhood. It's a neighborhood that's historically a home to newcomers to Canada. So, for instance, for the last 10 years, Parkdale has been a main landing spot for Tibetan refugees in Canada. And so it's got a significant Tibetan population, but all sorts of immigrant people make their home in the neighborhood.
And let's talk a little bit about that gentrification. What's driving it? I know in American cities, a lot of it's like tech capital or even the weed industry, like basically new capital coming in, buying up properties, causing the rent to go up because their people need to work somewhere. How is gentrification played out in the neighborhood where Parkdale is? And just how would you describe this process? Has it been a long or short process? What's going on there?
Right. Well, I think some of the ways that it's played out is just the standard kind of stuff. So businesses moving into storefronts in the neighborhood that cater to perhaps more affluent demographic. So working class cafes and bars being replaced by fancier restaurants and that sort of thing. The art scene, I guess, has played its role as it typically does and that kind of thing. But I think the main sort of pressures come from the real estate market. And so you have capital investment in real estate in the neighborhood taking the form of investors coming in and buying up some of the smaller buildings where people live. And then sort of these new, bigger corporate landlords coming in and buying up the apartment buildings and attempting to upscale the buildings by pushing out the long-term working class tenants.
In Toronto, in Canada, I don't know how you're seeing this, but what happens to people when they're pushed out? Because I think this is a big question for capitalism in general in these big cities. If you push out the people that drive the buses, that wait the tables, that work at the bars, who's going to be left to actually run your techno-capitalist future mega city?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, in Toronto, the trend has been that obviously working class people get pushed out of the downtown core and the neighborhoods in and around downtown and are forced to take up residency in the inner suburban sections of the city.
Right.
So that's the movement that you see.
Right.
But again, in Parkdale, where there is such a density of rental housing, it becomes more difficult for capital under the existing legislative framework to remove that base of tenants.
Gotcha. Well, let's just talk about how not only you came to be involved in Parkdale Organized, but how the group came about. Was this a group that existed before the rent strike? Was it something that organically came out of people organizing? How did you go from just people in the neighborhood, living at the building, to all of a sudden there's a group and then you're on rent strike? How was that process made?
Right. It's a group that's been around for about 4 years now, and it was rather deliberately organized. But what it came out of was initially struggles against one of these big real estate companies that came in and bought up a few of the apartment buildings in the neighborhood. A company called Achilles, which is a Scandinavian-based firm that's hit the Toronto rental market pretty hard in the last 5 years or so. So their model was to come in and buy up buildings and then begin a process of pushing out the long-term tenants through neglect, not keeping up on repair and maintenance in the buildings, harassing tenants, taking tenants to court for negligible sums of late rents, and then through the constant application of these big above guideline rent increases. So tenants in the four buildings that were initially bought up by Achilles formed committees and linked up with other tenants in the neighborhood who had some experience of struggle against landlords at that point. And they basically held a public meeting at the local library to talk about tenants getting organized and linking up across the neighborhood. That meeting was billed as Parkdale Organize. And so the name kind of stuck. And so the Achilles campaign was successful in a number of ways. One, by improving conditions in the buildings, beating back one of these above guideline rent increases by half, and by generally starting the process of sort of changing the social and political dynamics within the neighborhood, whereby working class people in the neighborhood became more apt to use collective organizing and collective action as a means to come together around their common interests. So that's really where the group got its start, and has been organizing pretty steadily since then, in a number of areas.
Well, let's talk about that decision actually to go on rent strike. How did that decision get made? Because I mean, that's a huge leap, and I don't know how many people lived in the building, but I'm assuming there were some people that probably were not on board at first. So what was that process like to actually get from a group of people that realized their common interests to we're actually going to take this huge leap and go on rent strike?
Right. So after the campaign against Achilles, Parkdale Organized continued to do work in the neighborhood. And so we were involved in a number of smaller fights against landlords in different buildings, helping tenants come together and form committees in their buildings. Then there was strike at the Ontario Food Terminal, which is a major employer where many tenants in Parkdale work. And so members of Parkdale Organize were involved in supporting a group of Parkdale workers who organized a union at the food terminal and went on strike for their first collective agreement there. Uh-huh. There's also work around education taken up by members of Parkdale Organize, where a lot of families in the neighborhood have concerns and issues with the schools and obviously their kids' education. So development of programs are to address some of the educational needs in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And all that work started to culminate in people turning to collective organizing as a strategy to deal with problems. So it was in January of this year that tenants at the first Metcalf building to go on rent strike approached Parkdale Organize and got the ball rolling on what became a neighborhood-wide movement. So their building, it's building of about 90 apartments, they decided to go on rent strike in advance of a court date that was going to decide or was going to approve one of these big rent increases at their building. And then rather intelligently and boldly, they decided to build that out into a neighborhood-wide struggle, because there at that time were five other Metcalf-managed buildings facing similar rent increases.
Wow, that's amazing. So people from within the building actually came to Parkdale Organize, this growing organization that's involved in all this different organizing, and they said, you know, we want to go on rent strike. What was the, like, how was that decision made? Did it just kind of happen and then it grew? Or, like, there was, like, mass meetings and then people just said, yeah, we're not going to pay anymore?
So at 87 Jameson, the decision to go on rent strike there was made in the lobby of that building in a meeting of tenants there. And then the next step out of there was they basically decided to organize a mass neighborhood meeting at the local library. So with along with Parkdale Organized members, they flyered all the other Metcalf buildings in the neighborhood, knocked on people's doors, told them about the situation, you know, put up posters, spread the word through social networks that already existed within the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And from that mass meeting, a multi-building campaign got underway. The immediate decision at that mass meeting was to take on Metcalf around disrepair issues in the buildings. So everybody in the building is sort of facing common problems in terms of pests, water damage, just poor living conditions. Uh-huh. So the building committees went about to document all the different disrepair and maintenance issues in the building, and that work culminated in a march on the landlord. So about 80 or so tenants showed up at Metcalf's corporate offices with a stack of documentation of the different repairs in the different buildings and apartments. Mm-hmm. And at that point, Metcalf started on a path of bad decision-making on their part and decided to not address the tenants in any way, locked them out, called the cops on them, and so on. And so it was that day at that march on the landlord where, instead of sort of putting their tail between their legs and going home after that action, the tenants actually held a mass meeting in the atrium of the landlord's corporate offices downtown. And it was there that the proposal to organize a neighborhood-wide rent strike was first floated.
Wow, that's really amazing. I'm just curious, we're going to talk more in a second about how it grew in the actual strike itself, but I'm just curious about, as far as Parkdale Organize, for the group itself, like, where did you all kind of get your inspiration for this kind of model of organizing? Obviously, like, it's not just you, but, you know, your inspiration for engaging this kind of work, because listening to this, this sounds like a lot of the stuff that Solidarity Networks have engaged in, except on a much wider level in some ways.
Right. Well, I mean, some of us in Parkdale Organize have taken the view that in this period, what needs to happen is we need to build independent working class organizations. We're in a period where there are pretty much zero mass organizations of working class people that exist. And so begs the question for revolutionaries, where do you do the work? So for us, for some of us, it's to build these working class organizations that can then carry out working class struggles and begin to take control of aspects of our daily lives. And one of the places where we believe we're well situated to do that is in neighborhoods, in defined urban territories, where by virtue of living together in concentrated areas, working class people associate and come up against common struggles and common class enemies. So in terms of building working class organization on a neighborhood level, in Parkdale, the apartment buildings present themselves as a viable basis to do that. So there are these buildings where many, many people and families live, and people associate there. They're obviously against their landlords, and it provides a basis at the building level for people to begin to come together and form committees and begin to make decisions together about how to carry out these struggles. So that's sort of the basic theory that's underlied the work in Parkdale Organized from the beginning. And I guess the rent strike is sort of it's been the highest level of that sort of organization that we've seen in the neighborhood to date.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. You know, one thing, another question I think a lot of people ask themselves in situations similar to this or this similar kind of work is just how to kind of erase that kind of line or that distinction between, you know, quote, organizer and then just somebody that's a tenant that's, you know, coming to these meetings or something like that. How did you kind of grapple with that tension?
Well, I mean, the majority of the members of Parkdale Organize live in the apartment buildings in the neighborhood. Gotcha. Those of us who don't live in the neighborhoods either work in the neighborhood, like myself. I work at a social service agency in the neighborhood, so I'm around quite a bit. And yeah, I mean, there's a couple other people who used to live in the neighborhood who don't live there anymore, who come to the neighborhood to participate in the work. But yeah, by far, most of the members actually live in the neighborhood.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Well, let's just get back to the strike itself. So the campaign is kicked off. There's a rent strike called. How did the company respond? And just, you know, tell us about just kind of in the midst of the campaign. I mean, people aren't paying. There's rallies and marches and protests. Just what was that like?
Right. Well, so the march on Metcalfe's head office was in March, the month of March 2017. And so it was there that the proposal to organize a neighborhood-wide rent strike was put out there. And then so during March and April, the building committees in the affected buildings were very busy making their preparations for a May 1st rent strike. So each building committee essentially recruited neighbors unit by unit, apartment by apartment, to participate in the rent strike. So each building started taking a list of all those neighbors in their building that would be participating, and sort of a targeted organizing process went around that. So each committee had a list that would have sort of yeses, nos, and maybes. People who were immediately interested, people who didn't want anything to do with it, and people who were sort of on the fence or had questions. And then as the May 1st sort of deadline approached, the committees made concerted efforts to go and target the maybes and bring them on board to the rent strike. And so all that work was done through door knocking, door to door, through lobby meetings in the apartment building lobbies, and then through mass meetings where tenants from the different buildings would meet together at the local library to discuss the issues. So that's sort of how the nuts and bolts of the organizing to get to a rent strike happened. I guess I should also say that in the month of April, tenants hung banners off from their windows and balconies in the building saying May 1st rent strike. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that the landlord attempted to retaliate against the tenants. So multiple tenants who had hung banners received eviction notices from the landlords, accusing them of using their apartments as bases for illegal activity. So it'd be the same type of eviction notice that a landlord would give if they were accusing a tenant of drug trafficking or so on.
What happened with those tenants that got those eviction notices?
Well, I mean, it sparked a number of actions. So the landlord went so far as to send its employees to the doors of some of the tenants and give them ultimatums that if they didn't take the banners down, that the landlord's agents were going to enter the unit, cut the banners down. And so there were actions organized to confront and block the landlord's agents from doing so, which were successful. And that sort of built the resolve of the tenant organizers, some of whom were at first pretty freaked out by the fact that the landlord was trying to evict them over a banner.
Right.
But when tenants saw that they had the backing of the neighbors and other people in the neighborhood, sort of built the confidence further. And yeah, so that was the banner stuff. And then, on April 30th, the day before the rent strike was set to begin, there was a march through the neighborhood. So tenants met up at the local library and had a demonstration through the streets of Parkdale. And that was another moment where people's confidence was really built up. A lot of people from the neighborhood joined the demonstration as it was going along, and people were waving and cheering from the balconies of the apartment buildings and that sort of thing. So I think a lot of tenants talked about that being an important moment going into the rent strike. And then on May 1st, we had about 200 tenants and six buildings begin to withhold their rent. And the landlord didn't really know how to react to it. The landlord didn't proceed with evictions as quickly as they could have. And that was probably a poor strategic decision on the landlord's part. So about 2 or 3 weeks into May, nobody had even received an eviction notice.
Oh, wow.
So by the time June came around, and organizing throughout May continued. So we had 200 people on rent strike in May, and then the organizers decided during May to go out to the buildings where we didn't have support yet and to encourage more people to join on June 1st. And so on June 1st, another 100 or more tenants joined the strike. So at its high point, there's about 300 people withholding rent. So withholding over $1 million in rent money at that point.
Wow, that's crazy. Wow, that's so inspiring. You know, I'm curious, you know, in the U.S., when situations like this break out and it feels like something like this maybe could begin to happen, I feel like a lot of working class people kind of fall back on these like legal frameworks or, you know, trying to get somebody to listen to them, either like a elected representative or like try to go down a legal route of like going through some nonprofit. Like, and I think it's really important you bring up this idea of people building confidence through collective action. I'm just curious, like, if at times people did bring up those other measures of either trying to like go down a legal route or maybe going to like a local elected official to try to listen to their demands or something like that, and how people got to the point where they felt like, you know, really like through collective action, that's how we're actually going to win.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, all those proposals were put forward during the course of the organizing, and it took the concerted intervention of revolutionaries in order to argue for a strategy that was based in collective action and not lobbying and not legal action. That said, I mean, as things started to get rolling and people saw the impact and efficacy of their actions, those arguments became less difficult to make. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I guess come back to the actions around the banners, for instance. When some of the tenants received the eviction notices for hanging banners, you know, some of them did call the local politicians and say, this is outrageous, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But what backed the landlord off those evictions was tenants coming together to block the landlord agents from coming into the units. Mm-hmm. So the actions that people took throughout the course of the campaign sort of demonstrated that it was really only through collective action that people had the power to move the thing forward.
Right. Well, let's talk about the victory. How did the actual win come about? Was this a process? Was this done through negotiations with the landlord? How was victory kind of finally achieved?
Right. Well, a couple things happened in late May and early June. So, throughout the rent strike, there was a series of actions where tenants would come together, basically form like a flying squad from the tenants in their building to go make demands on the property manager. Mm-hmm. And in one case, at one of the buildings, was an elderly couple, like two tenants who were in their late 80s kind of thing, who are living in really deplorable conditions in their unit and had been neglected by the landlord. So their neighbors came around them during the rent strike to organize an action to go together to the property manager to demand that repairs be made to their unit. And at that action, when tenants confronted the property manager at the building, he actually fled. And so it created a rather odd situation where tenants were following this property manager through the neighborhood. He tried to hide on a construction site at one of the other buildings, and he ended up calling the CEO of the company, I guess, to come rescue him from the tenants. And in the course of that action, the CEO basically hit one of the tenants with a truck. And so that made the front page of the Toronto Star and everything else. And so that was kind of a big error on the part of the landlord in terms of building public sympathy in the favor of the rent strikers. The CEO of this big company was running people down in his truck. It didn't look very good. And then a really important action in June was when one of the building's rent increases was set to go for approval at court. And so instead of letting that happen, the tenants occupied and shut down the court. And I think it was sort of after that action that the landlord, I think, realized that, you know, the processes, the state processes that it generally relied on to get these rent increases was not functioning. And so it was at that point that they came to the table to negotiate a settlement to the strike.
Wow. So it was a combination of them just fucking up so bad and just the sustained working class insurgency against them that ultimately made them.
Yeah. Yeah, at the end of the day, these capitalists do depend on state processes to get their profits, right? And right. So the tenants weren't allowing for that process to happen. Mm-hmm. And so I think at that point they were kind of at a loss as to what to do.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, you know, the relationships that were built during the strike. I mean, can you just describe these? I know in the documentary from Submedia, there's a really moving part where they talk about, you know, like, I didn't really talk to my neighbors before, and now I do, and there's a sense of community that came out of the struggle. Can you just talk a little bit about that and just maybe how this continues to this day, you know, even though the rent strike is now over? Just kind of the different non-capitalist relationships that were created out of this.
I guess I would talk about it as existing on at least two levels organizationally. Like, there's each building that participated in the rent strike had its building committee, which conducted the organizing in that building. So the members of those building committees are immediate neighbors in their own buildings. And so I think a lot of strong relationships were forged at the building level between neighbors who live in the same building who participated in the rent strike. And then on sort of more the neighborhood-wide level, obviously it was, you know, once the rent strike ended, Parkdale Organize had on its hands, you know, a good number of the most sort of committed and militant tenants from the rent strike who we then wanted to invite into the organization to move forward working class struggles in Parkdale. And so that process has been underway since the strike ended and has given way to a number of other fights and struggles immediately. So there was a successful action to stop the evictions of three neighbors who live above a storefront in the neighborhood whose building was sold to a Domino's pizza franchise owner who wanted to evict them. Parkdale Organized members linked up with those tenants to back the landlord off those evictions. That was last month. Last week, another group of Parkdale workers who work at the Ontario Food Terminal went out on strike for their first collective agreement. So Parkdale Organized members have been going out to support their picket line and strategize with the workers how to move their struggle forward there.
Wow, that's just so inspiring. Oh my gosh.
And yeah, it's interesting to see how a neighborhood-based strategy of building working class organizations with the apartment buildings as the social base for those organizations can sort of translate into then workplace-based organizations by those same tenants who live in the apartment buildings. Like, about half of the workers who are on strike now at the food terminal were rent strikers in the summer. Mm-hmm. So some of those relationships are definitely, you know, inspiring and instructive, I guess, in terms of how this type of organizing can actually make political gains beyond one fight.
Right. You know, one thing I want to ask, a lot of this to me brings to mind the experience of anarchists in the poll tax movement in the UK in the late 1980s. And I think there was always a question there from people that I've talked to that have been involved with that of just like, to put it a certain way, like, how political do you get? You know, do you also push, you know, outwardly, like, you know, anti-capitalist, anti-colonial, you know, anti-state ideas, and or just, you know, I'm also part of this group, or, you know, I identify as this way, like, in your organizing? Or does that come kind of like as you make relationships with people, or is it both? I'm just curious your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I think as revolutionaries, we're a lot of the time we're drawing from political traditions within the working class movement, whether, you know, anarchist traditions or others, that have their reference point sort of like 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's fine and that makes sense to a degree. But I think where we're at now is that the gains that those traditions within the working class movement were able to make have been and are being rolled back. And the political decomposition of the working class, at least in our area, has resulted in a really degenerate left and revolutionary milieu that lacks for politics which are relevant to our current historical moment. And so I think our hope is that through engaging in a process of building independent working class organization that involves the maximum number of working class people on a neighborhood basis, will actually begin to be able to engage in a process of developing new revolutionary politics that are relevant to our current situation. And so for me, like, it doesn't really matter if I identify as an anarchist or whatever. It's whether the politics, the strategies, the proposals for action that I put forward, are they anarchistic or not?
Right.
And
right.
Are they viable or not? Mm-hmm. I think that's where push comes to shove.
Right. Well, that's a beautiful answer. And I'm just curious, you know, you brought up the left, you know, did, you know, in the U.S., it would be one would assume that like an alphabet soup of different Leninist groups or whatever would show up to this and try to take it over or use it as a photo op to sell their paper or something like that. Did that happen? Was that a problem or no?
Yeah, 100%. obviously. I mean, yeah, at a certain point, you know, a good portion of the work becomes managing and keeping away the leftists, right?
Right.
So that's just a fact of life.
Right.
But I mean, really, I mean, on the plus side, most of these, you know, so-called revolutionaries are pretty fucking lazy. So it's not like they're really getting their hands dirty trying to get into the actual day-to-day organizing. They're for the most part doing what you described in terms of showing up for photo ops at particular actions and that kind of thing. So yeah, but it's an issue. For sure.
I think, you know, to go off on a tangent here, I just feel like you know, in the US there's been a, you know, this heightened moment of anti-fascism, which for a lot of people has created this idea of left unity, where, you know, the importance is put on, you know, keeping various left-wing groups together, which in reality really don't have a basis of unity to begin with politically. Whereas, you know, what you're talking about, I think, is much more exciting, is finding finding affinity and a sense of community and a project together through shared conditions and trying to organize against them and so on and so forth. And actually, in reality, these so-called revolutionary groups that kind of come in to manage the struggle, which is, you know, the majority of what both the left does, are really problematic. And so in that instance, you know, this idea of left unity, you know, obviously makes no sense. And instead, what we're talking about is, you know, a coming together of proletarians to, you know, resist their conditions and create a different kind of way of life. So I don't know. I think that's a very important insight to make.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like from my perspective, the what revolutionaries need to do generally, like serious ones, I guess, is to abandon the left in its entirety. And I mean, I would include in that, you know, the vast majority of what goes on in anarchist subcultural milieus. Mm-hmm. And yeah, get together with anybody around you who shares, you know, your level of seriousness, and set about to find ways to actually intervene within working class life in your area.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Well, let's just close in asking about, I mean, like this model that you all have done. I know, like, for instance, in San Francisco, there's also another rent strike that's been going on for a long time. In the downtown area, there's actually a video about it that's very similar to the Submedia documentary. It's on Global Uprisings, if you want to check that out. I don't know the status of it right now, but I know from what I've seen online, I think it might be one of the longest-running rent strikes in the U.S. You know, very similar context, you know, with gentrification going on. But I'm just curious, you know, for anybody that's listening to this that you know, is hearing what you're saying and is living in an area where it's becoming rapidly gentrified, just what advice would you give to them about, you know, wanting to get involved in this kind of organizing? What should they do?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, I would say that it's important to understand that in Parkdale, a rent strike was taken up as a tactic, right? And so, I mean, the goal should not be just to go around trying to incite rent strikes here, there, and everywhere. Right. That rent strike obviously is a tactic that's based on the ability of tenants to withdraw their rent money as a way to put forward their demands. Mm-hmm. And that only came about as a viable strategy in Parkdale after years of concerted organizing and intervention in that neighborhood. So I would definitely caution against anybody who's thinking, oh, well, we should be going out and organizing a rent strike because rent strikes are good. I think for revolutionaries to take up the task of building independent working class organizations where they live and work, I think that there's a bunch of stuff that goes into that. I think that finding a few people that you can commit to a process of doing it with is important. I think doing social research or investigation into the area or areas that you're considering taking up work is important. And then, yeah, building up connections with obviously the people who you live around, taking on fights that are winnable, and yeah, building slowly.
Yeah. And you also brought up just not going around like telling people to do a rent strike. I feel like, anarchists, I mean, I know I did when I was younger, but, I feel like a lot of anarchists are like, oh, well, if you can't pay for rent, you should just like squat or something, or, you know, like just like giving people, you know, so-called solutions that really aren't viable for most people, or that us ourselves are not actually not only capable of, but are actually not engaging in. And I think also, too, what's really interesting about with Parkdale Organize is just this kind of interesting mix between, you know, organizing, you know, this kind of like, you know, continual activity, but also like there is this level of spontaneity and people responding to the situation and, you know, people calling for a rent strike. So it's not one or the other. It's not like waiting for something to pop off, but it's also understanding that we have to be organized and bringing people together and carrying out action for those moments of spontaneity and action to actually matter.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like before the rent strike popped off in Parkdale, like we, for years, we've been going into buildings. Like we have a newsletter, right? So every 2 or 3 months, we're publishing a newsletter highlighting some of the struggles and successes that people were having in the neighborhood through organizing. And we would get out, you know, 2,000-3,000 copies of that newsletter in the apartment buildings where our members live. And so in other buildings where we didn't have contacts yet. And so people would contact us through the newsletter, like call us up or shoot us an email. And so we would be invited to go meet with tenants in their buildings. And so we did that a lot. And in some cases, no organizing would get off the ground whatsoever. In other cases, we would begin a process of organizing in a certain building and it would only go so far or didn't go anywhere at all. But through the process of doing that work, sort of an opinion or a consciousness began to form in the neighborhood that collective organization and collective action was an appropriate and potentially effective way of dealing with common problems that people face. And so,
yeah, or that it even exists at all, because most people don't.
Exactly.
Most people don't even have a conception of that, you know.
Exactly. And so that work, I think, laid the ground for when tenants at 87 Jameson got people together to propose a neighborhood-wide rent strike. It was something that that people considered. It wasn't something that people just brushed off or rejected right away. Yeah. So in that sense, it certainly didn't come out of nowhere. But yeah, I mean, that to your other point, yeah, it's like there is this tendency by anarchists, by leftists, just to fetishize a particular tactic or a particular form of struggle when that's generally not at all productive. And that instead what needs to happen is sort of a concerted political intervention over time.
Right. Well, as somebody once told me, like, we know that shit is going to happen. And, like, you know, so many bad things are going to happen. I mean, just looking at, you know, the world politically, economically, ecologically especially, I mean, so many things are going to break down and happen that people are going to respond to. But the ability of people to kind of lose their illusions, not only about the left or politics, but also about their own ability and self-activity is going to be based on their lived experiences. And if they don't have any of those experiences, you know, when shit does pop off, you know, they are going to look to somebody else to solve their problems or, you know, just be kind of led into the ashes of history.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, there's no shortage of things to organize around, and there's no shortage of intelligence and creativity and history within the working class to draw from in terms of how to go about waging particular struggles. I think what's lacking most of the time is the sort of concerted, ongoing intervention of revolutionaries and just the ability of revolutionaries just to be generally reliable, like dependable. Right. Members of the class in their area, right?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we've been talking to Cole from Parkdale Organize. Again, if you want to watch an amazing documentary on a rent strike that was successful in so-called Toronto, go to sub.media, check out one of their latest posts. It's a 30-minute documentary. It's same people that do Trouble that have been around for years. Set up a screening in your neighborhood, in your community center. I mean, this would be a great film to kind of show people not only about collective action, but, you know, how to resist gentrification. And actually, in the film, it really breaks down just the kind of bullshit, stupid, yuppie gentrification that goes on. I mean, if you live in a big city where that's happening, you're going to automatically connect to that kind of bullshit. that they talk about very briefly. But in closing, is anything else you want to highlight or give a shout out to? Anything else you want to say as far as how people can follow the work of Parkdale Organize?
Well, I mean, first of all, thanks very much for talking with us and for spreading the word about the film and the struggle. And thanks to Heat Score there from Submedia for all his tireless effort in putting the thing together. But yeah, if people want to follow Parkdale Organize, they can do so through the usual ways. We have a website, parkdaleorganize.ca. There's a Facebook page, Parkdale Organize. Yeah, all our contact info and all the past issues of our newsletter and everything is on the website.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for coming on. I mean, it's really, really inspiring just hearing this story. And I mean, it's exciting to see, you know, where this will continue to grow.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot for your interest. It was good talking to you.
Awesome. Have a good one.
Take care, buddy.
Judging from the car they drive, I know they not poor. And I could be mistaken because I'm not sure, but I got this little hunch. They the ones calling the cops 4 times last week, saying I'm disturbing the peace, cause I was playing my music and they heard some loud screams. So my neighbor the cop, who I suspect of beating his wife, had to tell me to stop. And I wish I had the guts to tell him about the noise from Mr. Croft, but that's the business that I don't get involved with. So I look the other way, trying to climb higher, cause if I reach the top I think I could escape. Goodbye. Around his knuckles, ready to swing the buckle. I'm thinking, why they fighting each other? They're in the same school, probably live next to each other, under the same roof. I bet they're from my building, yeah, I bet that kid's dad's the drunk I pass on my way up the stairs, real sad. I'm sure they blame him for the tags in the hallway, the robberies, not seeing the reason, he's outside all day, like they came from nowhere.